are going to talk about polytainment this hour. What's polytainment, you ask? Well, we'll find out. And we'll also find out what this song has to do with one of the 10 rules of contemporary politics. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 8 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Friday, April the 6th. We will talk with a political science professor who has authored the book Polytainment, the 10 Rules of Contemporary Politics, which is dubbed as being a citizen's guide to understanding campaigns and elections. We will talk with him about how politics is entertainment these days and how it's a business too. And we will welcome your thoughts, your questions, and your reactions for our guest at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is David Schultz. He is author of Polytainment, the 10 Rules of Contemporary Politics. He is a Hamline University professor in the School of Business in St. Paul, Minnesota. He is the author of more than 25 books on American politics, media and politics, campaigns and elections. He joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you today?
I'm great. So what is the definition of polytainment?
Well, polytainment is really the merging of politics and entertainment, and it refers to a trend that I started seeing quite a few years ago regarding how you start to see entertainment people such as Ronald Reagan, in my state many years ago, people such as Jesse Ventura, Arnold Schwarzenegger, entertainers entering politics, and how politicians increasingly use entertainment venues and entertainment techniques to try to both push their brand and to reach out to voters. And so it's a product of an era where we now have the, you know, cable news era, the 365, era of constant sort of political commentary and analysis, and at a time when candidates are searching and competing against all other forms of distractions to get voters' attention. Again, they have to turn to entertainment venues to get their message out.
Mm-hmm. So that's why we are seeing this happening, is that there's just too much in the media, and they need to do whatever they can to be seen and heard.
Partly that's correct. Yeah, I mean, think back about, 40 years ago or something, that on one level, if you wanted to get political information out, your basic choices were, or political news out, you had the three major networks, CBS, ABC, NBC, and everybody was watching Walter Cronkite or somebody like that. And that's how people got their information. And people probably read the daily newspaper, and that was the source. So if you were a politician, you wanted to get information out, it was easy to reach people. But now, fast forward it now, where we have, however many channels on television, plus radio, the internet, we have the web, we have Twitter, we have social media. There's just an intense competition just to grasp people's attention. And with that kind of competition, we already know that mainstream news, the number of people who watch mainstream news or listen to it, it's quite low. What is it? I think a Pew Center for People in the Press did a study a few years ago that pointed out that approximately 50% of those under the age of 30 get most of their news from non-traditional formats such as Comedy Central. So with people not being in sort of traditional news formats anymore, candidates for office really have to go into different locations to really get people's attention so that they'll vote for them.
Tell us some examples of how we are seeing this concept play out in the 2012 elections.
Well, how we're seeing it play out in the 2012 election, I think, is a little bit it's sort of a continuation of what we saw from the last couple of elections. But think about it already in terms of the fact that we've had several of the major presidential candidates appearing on, Jon Stewart at Comedy Central. Letterman and Leno seem to be regular features in terms of those candidates. All of them have Facebook pages, are using Twitter, and that's in some way a playing off of what Barack Obama very successfully did in 2008 in terms of having social media, in terms of driving his campaign. And those seem to be just some of the examples. My suspicion is as we start to move further into the, you know, the presidential election, as we're getting towards the general election, what we'll start to see is the candidates appearing not just on those shows that I mentioned, but you'll see them doing things, and I'll speculate, you know, you'll see them appearing on shows such as, you know, the Ellen DeGeneres Show on television and a variety of others. Because we know in the past, shows, for example, such as the Oprah Show when it was still on the air, was a very popular place. Barack Obama was on there, and look again to see not just sort of what we'd consider to be sort of traditional news shows, you know, the Sunday morning news shows or something like that, but a variety of different areas in terms of exploring different formats, looking for different segments, because what the candidates will do is to look and try to figure out what demographic do they want to reach in terms of type of voter, and then figure out what show, what radio show, what website they're going to, and try to advertise that way. And so I would look to see that, and it's starting to happen now. Now, the other thing that oftentimes happens, and I haven't seen that much yet this year, is that candidates will try to moniker or to try to sort of appropriate sort of pop culture phrases from commercials, for example, as ways of pushing their campaign. You know, one of my favorite examples goes back a long time ago when Walter Mondale was running for president and his main challenger was Gary Hart, and he stole an old Wendy's commercial line, "Where's the beef?" you know, to attack Gary Hart, mm-hmm. in terms of criticizing him, saying he doesn't have a lot of substance there. And so I haven't seen quite that much yet this year in terms of, you know, efforts to appropriate, sort of, what I say, more commercial or mainstream themes. But they're out there, I suspect, and we'll see them in the next few months.
We just went through, of course, the primary in Wisconsin, and I have to laugh because my producer-director, Bill Martins, wondered if the politicians could do something to make their robocalls more entertaining.
Yes, they probably could. You know, and I was going to say, well, I mean, first off, we can have a great debate whether or not those robocalls are effective, you know, because for lots of people, they do find them very annoying. And I suspect that's probably the next step here. I mean, some states, for example, have banned or significantly restricted robocalls, but in states that have not, I think you could probably do some very interesting things, whether it's in terms of, again, themes like this. Maybe you get some famous celebrity, you know, to pick up the line or something. And so you pick up the line initially, and you have some famous actress and saying, "This is so-and-so, and I want to talk to you about Rick Santorum or Mitt Romney or something like that." Or maybe it leads in with some kind of, you know, interesting jingle or something like that. I mean, in many ways, they could probably borrow from Madison Avenue in terms of advertising to figure out better ways of sort of kicking into the message as opposed to the way they're currently constructed right now, which I actually find kind of sort of crude in the sense of they're trying to basically hit you over the head with a sledgehammer.
Yeah, well, I certainly want to talk with you more about polytainment and the 10 rules of contemporary politics that you outline in the book as we go along this morning. But I wonder, since we're fresh off our primary, if you have any analysis or reaction to the results with Mitt Romney defeating Rick Santorum in Wisconsin in the primary, where Rick Santorum actually did win almost all of the counties, but more of the rural counties around Wisconsin, and Mitt Romney ended up taking the big population counties in southeastern Wisconsin. Any thoughts on what we saw happen in Wisconsin this week?
Yeah, two observations. You know, one is that for the last several weeks, people have wanted to say consistently that the next big primary was going to be the decisive one. You know, so they said that about Ohio, a whole bunch of different ones. I actually think Wisconsin was a very decisive primary in terms of the fortunes for both Santorum and Romney, because had Santorum actually sort of pulled it off in terms of actually winning the primary, overall, not just simply the pattern that you described there, it would have continued to cast doubt on Mitt Romney's, you know, viability and ability to sort of coalesce, you know, support. But the fact that he did win, I think, really makes it, you know, both mathematically even more improbable for Rick Santorum to prevail, you know, but also at the same time gives Mitt Romney enough momentum to keep moving forward. At this point, he merely has to get like barely 50% of the remaining delegates, you know, to get to clinch the nomination. But the other thing that I think was just really interesting in terms of looking at the Romney Santorum split is that Romney still hasn't really sealed the deal with an important wing of his political party, sort of the social conservatives. And if you look at the patterns that Romney won in the state of Wisconsin, it's similar to the patterns he's won in the rest of the United States. He's winning in areas where Democrats normally would do well. And, you know, that could suggest that, okay, maybe he's competitive with Barack Obama, but also I would say that these are areas of the country, states of the country, for example, you know, when he won Massachusetts and when he won states, you know, like Maryland and that, states that Republicans just never gonna win. And so he's not winning. So he's winning in the areas where Democrats or where Republicans are never going to win, but he's not sealing the deal in areas where Republicans traditionally do well. Doesn't mean that he's not going to, you know, win some of those areas in a general election. But when I get to the rules of politics later, what he doesn't seem to have is the passion among the Republicans in terms of really supporting him. And so that's where I think Wisconsin was interesting, is that even though he wins but in a way that's not completely suggesting that the party is coalescing behind him and it's really excited about him.
We are talking with Hamline University professor David Schultz, who is author of Polytainment, The 10 Rules of Contemporary Politics. And we're welcoming your questions for him, maybe about contemporary politics that we just witnessed this week in Wisconsin, or maybe about this this concept of polytainment, that politics is more and more like entertainment. And we'll talk more too about how our guest considers it a business too. And we welcome your questions, your views. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org, or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. It's going to be sunny and cool today with high temperatures upper 40s in northern Wisconsin, getting to near 60 degrees in the south.
Basically a good guy, and, you know, I'm happy with him saying he'd like to be part of an administration with me. Nothing wrong with that. If he's the VP, that's better.
Yeah.
I'd rather be the president, let him be the vice president.
That's Mitt Romney on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno in late March, talking about Rick Santorum's comment that he would be Romney's vice president. We are talking about how that's an example of polytainment. Polytainment, as our guest says, is sort of a merger between entertainment and politics. And we are talking about polytainment and current issues on the campaign trail as well with David Schultz, author of Polytainment, The 10 Rules of Contemporary Politics. He's a Hamline University professor in the School of Business in St. Paul, Minnesota. And again, that's an example of polytainment, the presidential candidate stumping on Jay Leno, Professor Schultz.
Yes, it is. And I'm going to give you sort of the best example that shows the impact that sort of the polytainment concept has. And one of my two good ones, and they're both involving Clintons. You know, in many ways, one of the best examples of sort of how entertainment venues helped the candidate goes back in the early 90s when Bill Clinton appeared on what was then the Arsenio Hall show. And there's a famous scene where Bill Clinton, you know, dons his sunglasses and starts playing the saxophone.
Right.
And it had a huge impact upon people thinking, well, this guy's a really cool person. And it clearly had an impact in terms of how we viewed the younger people. But one of my favorite incidences to point to is during 2000 U.S. Senate race in New York between Hillary Clinton and Rudolph Giuliani, latter being the former, you know, mayor of New York. And she appeared, that is, Hillary Clinton was going to appear on the David Letterman show, and it just happened to be polling that was done. The day before she went on the show, she was about 4 to 5 points behind Rudy Giuliani in the mayor's race. She goes on David Letterman, yucks it up with him, does her version of sort of a Letterman top 10, and by all accounts was a hit. After the show was done, in the next couple of days, polling was done, and she had about a 3 to 4 point lead over Giuliani and never looked back. And most people attribute sort of the change in terms of her political fortunes to the fact that she went on that show sort of gave a human face to who she was, and it had a huge impact, especially with swing voters. And that's one of our clearest examples, but we see others. Again, when Arnold Schwarzenegger went on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno many years ago to declare that he was running for governor of California when they were doing the recall of Gray Davis. I mean, we just have numerous incidents of that. In terms of how candidates have been very successful of going on those types of shows in, again, reaching a certain demographic, a demographic of people who don't normally, you know, pay attention to the news. And that has really sort of sown the efficacy, you know, and the strength of going and using these entertainment venues. And then, again, the other examples, you know, that we can use here, and you played, and we'll probably talk about this, you played the Fleetwood Mac song, Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow, at the top of the show.
Mm-hmm.
Campaigns always have theme songs, always have what I call candidates have to have narratives. In fact, it's the most important rule of politics, a good narrative or story to tell. And what was absolutely brilliant about the 92 campaign for Bill Clinton is that he used the Fleetwood Mac song, Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow, as a theme song to capture thinking about, you know, where he wants to take the presidency. And in many ways, no different than when Ronald Reagan in 1984 made it his theme, It's Morning in America, trying to evoke images of sort of a future optimism and a narrative that makes us feel good about the world. And so these are the kind of ways that candidates can sort of adopt, again, slogans, themes, pop culture icons or characteristics in terms of helping them. Ronald Reagan, I was going to say quickly, was very good at that also in terms of invoking them.
Yeah, and you mentioned also in the book that this looking to the future, looking to tomorrow was what politicians ought to do if they want to win votes, because Hillary Clinton, you said, sort of evoked the past,
yeah,
whereas Barack Obama was saying we're looking forward and change.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things in terms of talking about, again, the power of narratives, the power of sort of themes for your campaign, is that generally looking to the past isn't successful. Americans are basically optimistic people. We always want to hope that, you know, over the next hill, over the next horizon, it's a better day. And so that not only do you have to have a powerful narrative, a good story to tell, but it has to be about tomorrow, which is one of my other rules of politics. And again, think about the powerful narrative of Ronald Reagan, It's Morning in America, Bill Clinton, Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow, about the narrative that Barack Obama used 4 years ago, which was all about change and hope. And then Hillary Clinton's narrative was to say, well, let's look back to the days when my husband was president. Things were pretty good back then. And generally, people don't want to sort of look at it and say, well, this is what it was like in the past. They want to know, is it going to be better in the future? Is it going to be more optimistic in the future? And I think that's really important. That's one of the mistakes that she made, is in terms of using a narrative that wasn't about the future but was about the past. And again, it has to be that narrative that's also very, very optimistic. I think of Tim Pawlenty, who was governor of Minnesota, the state where I live in. You know, when he was running for president last year, I remember the day that he declared he was running for president, he was down in Des Moines, and I can remember his speech saying that something along the fact he's saying that, well, if I'm elected, I'm going to say no to farmers, I'm going to say no to Wall Street, I'm going to say no to homeowners. And I listened to it and I said, this is a really dark image of the future. And even if accurate, people don't vote for the dark. They vote for optimism.
Yeah, so how does that optimism, or that need for a positive, optimistic narrative, how is that playing out between, say, President Obama and Mitt Romney?
Well, this is the real challenge right now. Now, think back again to 2008. Barack Obama had a brilliant narrative. It was a great narrative, which was about hope and change. Now, forward to 2010, can you think of what the Democrats' narrative was in 2010? And that's the problem right there. They didn't have a great narrative. You know, they didn't really have one. And I sometimes kid and say that the narrative that the Democrats had in 2010 was it could have been worse.
Mm-hmm.
And I use that because at one point, Tim Geithner, the Secretary of State, and Barack Obama said at one point, well, listen, had we not enacted the stimulus bill, the health care bill, the financial regulation bill, it could have been worse. Well, I don't know about you, but that's not exactly inspiring to me. It could have been worse. Now, the reason why I mention this is think about 2010. The Republicans had a brilliant narrative. I have no idea where they got it. It was highly original. You know what it was? Change.
Oh, they kind of borrowed one, huh?
They borrowed one. And so now think about it in 2012. What's the Republican narrative? It still is change. And now the question is, what is Barack Obama's narrative? And that's the question. That's the issue that I think Barack Obama is still struggling with. Is it the narrative of it can't be the narrative of change, because you know he's the incumbent. It can't be it could have been worse. He's trying to formulate a narrative about Barack Obama, the populist. Barack Obama's on your side, but that's the difficulty here right now, is that they're formulating, and Mitt Romney has the same problem. You know, Mitt Romney is trying to formulate a narrative that says, I'm competent with the economy, I'm competent in making jobs, I'm a business person, but he still hasn't zeroed in on, I think, a really good narrative for himself.
Let's take a call from Paul in La Crosse. Hello, Paul.
Hi. Basically, I'm just calling in to defend Comedy Central. The Colbert Report won the a Peabody Award the other day. They were awarded this week for their reporting and their informing on super PACs. Mm-hmm. And they've done a great thing. They've got the former attorney for the his PAC's attorney. Forget the guy's name now, but he used to be the head, I think, of the Elections Commission.
Trevor Potter.
And Paul, thank you for calling it. We're almost at our news break, so we're not necessarily bashing the Colbert Report by any means. But those comedy shows are doing some informing and many consider them news shows, right?
Right. I'm not criticizing them at all. I'm simply saying that the venue has changed at this point, and these are the shows that have tremendous influence over a good percentage of the population. And candidates for office are smart to understand that and go there.
We are talking with the author of Polytainment, The 10 Rules of Contemporary Politics, A Citizen's Guide to Understanding Campaigns and Elections. And after news, we'll talk more about the 10 Rules of Contemporary Politics, so you can have a better idea on how a candidate is being marketed to you. And we'll also talk about some current issues on the campaign trail. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org, or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is David Schultz. He is a Hamline University professor in the School of Business in St. Paul, Minnesota, author of Polytainment. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine at 7:36 on this Friday, April the 6th. We are talking about why candidates or politicians and campaigns do what they do and why some win and some lose. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We hope that you will join us as we talk with the author of Polytainment, The 10 Rules of Contemporary Politics, A Citizen's Guide to Understanding Campaigns and Elections. David Schultz is author of Polytainment. He is a Hamline University professor in the School of Business in St. Paul, Minnesota, the author of more than 25 books on American politics, media and politics, campaigns and elections, and election law. And we wonder if you agree with him that politics has evolved into polytainment, a merger of politics and entertainment. And we welcome your examples of that as well. And I do want to get into your 10 rules of contemporary politics and talk a bit how these rules are playing out on the campaign trail this year, Professor Schultz. We've talked about some of them, but not necessarily in order. Sure. Talk about rule number one. Politics is like selling beer.
Sure. Okay. Remember, I'm a professor, of course, and I got to reach the students. And I used to say to my students right off the bat, politics is like selling toothpaste, and they would never pay attention to me.
Okay.
And so I had to use the metaphor of selling beer. And the reason why I say that is that the essence of politics, the most important rule, is having a compelling narrative or a compelling story about yourself. And if you're running for office, you want to first be able to answer the most important question. I am running for president or senate or governor because, and then fill in the blank. Something that you can explain about yourself. And good narratives explain who you are, what you want to accomplish, what your vision is for the world. And the reason why I say that's important, think about almost all the other aspects of our life. How do we persuade people, or how do we communicate information? In the world of sales, for example, you know, watch television commercials. They're always telling stories about products. You know, buy this car and you'll have such and such an image. You know, wear this jewelry, you know, wear this perfume. All are stories. And the same thing for fundraising. Fundraising is all about telling stories. You know, an organization will say, give us money so that you can help this animal, this little girl, this cause, this country. And so a lot of how we persuade people is about telling really compelling narratives and stories. And that's where politicians have to start right off the bat, is having a really compelling narrative about who they are and what they want to accomplish. And we talked a little bit about this in the last half hour, is that, you know, candidates, you know, really need to describe who they are and what they stand for. And Barack Obama's narrative, of course, was the narrative of change, for example. You know, we talked about hope and change. And we've had other candidates who have used, again, different narratives. Ronald Reagan's, of course, we talked about, especially, you know, that when he was running in 1980, it was also change. It was change from Jimmy Carter. In 1984, then it was all about it's morning in America. So the narratives concept is really to say you need to have a powerful story about yourself. But I sort of link that with a couple of other rules of politics too. And I call the second rule that Annie is right. And Annie is referring to the famous musical Annie. And of course, we all know the most famous song in that musical is
Tomorrow, Tomorrow.
Tomorrow. And it's, again, optimism. And the same thing. Politics is always about tomorrow. And a good narrative is not only a good, compelling story, but it's a story about tomorrow, about how the future is going to be brighter than it's been in the past. And so the essence of sort of my first two rules of politics are how to craft really compelling narratives, slogans, themes, a feel about your campaign and about who you are that will make people want to get excited about you. And that, of course, then kicks into the third rule of politics. Now I'm showing my age when I say this, that says that Rod Stewart is right.
It took me a second to figure that one out.
This is a tougher one. It's a tougher one. And Rod Stewart did a great song many years ago called Passion. And politics is about passion, and that you have to get your supporters passionate about you for them to turn out to vote. And again, think about 2008, that Barack Obama clearly had the passion, that people were just enthusiastic about him and really, really intensely cared about him. Now jump to today, you know, in terms of the 2012 race. And this becomes fascinating, is that on the Democratic side, you still have Barack Obama trying to rekindle that passion, especially among the liberals and the progressive base of the party. And then on the Republican side, one of the criticisms of Mitt Romney is that he's a passionless candidate. You know, the polls seem to suggest that his supporters support him, but they're not excited about him. And passion is clearly an important variable in politics.
Yeah, and another criticism of Mitt Romney is something you see him trying to correct, but he seems to sometimes stick his foot in his mouth. He's trying to, look like the regular guy and to relate to the vote, you know, the regular voter. And
right.
And some people are saying he's having a very hard time doing that. I'm wondering if he's violating one of your rules to be, you know, to be who you are.
Yeah, exactly. He's violating in a couple of ways. One of them is it's about authenticity, that you really can't be somebody you're not. And I think the American public really can catch that well. And I love to tell this wonderful story back in 2004. I was speaking to the Jewish Community Center in St. Paul, Minnesota, not far from where I teach. And it was about the first week of October, maybe late September, I can't remember the exact day. And I finished my talk about presidential politics. And there was this darling woman, her name was Marjorie, darling woman, probably in her 80s, raises her hand and says to me, "Do you know why John Kerry's going to lose in 6 weeks?" And I said, "No, why?" She goes, "Because he's a snot." I said, "How do you know he's a snot?" You know, and I never heard a woman use the word snot so many times in the next 4 minutes in this conversation. And she said, "Well, up until 6 months ago," remember, this is back in 2004, she said, "Up until 6 months ago, my husband and I shared a condo right next to Teresa Hines Kerry and him, you know, in Boston. And so we were neighbors." And I said, "Okay." So I thought this was really interesting. And she said, "Well, why do you think he's a snot?" She said, "Well, he never says hi to me when he walks out of the condo. He never put his recycling out on the the right day, and he always parked his car in a way that hogged two spots. He's a snot, that's what she said. And her comment was that she said that, you know, he's not going to come across great in public simply because he doesn't come across great in person. And if you look at the, and we could dispute whether or not her observation was accurate or not, but if you looked at the opinion polls after the 2004 race, a lot of people said that the reason why they voted for Bush over Kerry is they felt like they could relate to George Bush better than they could relate to Mitt Romney.
Right.
John Kerry, you know, and so same problem now is that voters don't seem to be able to relate to Mitt Romney in the same way they couldn't relate to John Kerry, and that's a problem. And again, Romney doesn't help it by, you know, stupid comments by saying, like, I'll bet you $10,000 or something like that.
Right, right. And, yeah, it was famously there was some sort of poll, and most Americans said that they would rather go have a beer with George Bush than they would, you know, his opponent.
Yeah.
Does that mean that we're just a shallow electorate?
Well, I hope not. But it does suggest that, you know, we oftentimes apply different types of criteria, you know, for how we select the president. And it also suggests, though, that we may be susceptible to image building and to all the entertainment and marketing techniques that are very successful with commercials. You know, if again we go back to the concept of a narrative, that, you know, candidates are brands. You know, candidates are items that are being sold. This is part of the business aspect of politics, that they're selling a product and we're consumers. And so in the same way that we have pretty good evidence, you know, that we get persuaded or we're manipulated by, you know, by advertising campaigns, unfortunately it may be to say that the same thing happens with us in terms of politics, is that we fall in love with an image, we fall in love with a certain type of theme, and therefore, you know, at least a certain segment of the population, you know, goes along with what, you know, what some of us might think to be, you know, shallower, you know, imagery. But part of it now comes down to the fact that very few of us have time to spend our entire life researching politics, and we have to go from a variety of cues and statements to be able to sort of make sense of the political world. And so that may be part of the problem here, is that in our limited time where we're worried about our kids, our jobs, our health care, and so forth, you know, we turn to these other venues which don't always give us the amount of information that we need to be really well informed.
Chris in Eau Claire joins us now. Hello, Chris.
Good morning. How are you guys today?
Great.
The reason I was calling is I was listening a few days ago, and you had a guest on. And I believe his first name was John. Your screener told me his full name. Where you were talking about the differences in what Rush Limbaugh, the comments that he had made, versus comments that Bill Maher and you know, all of these quote-unquote entertainers made. And the reason I would call in is because, you know, I'm kind of agreeing with your guest today. You know, I see today's generation getting all of their information and forming their opinions based on these comedians, you know, not necessarily watching or listening because they want political information, but because they're handed that. And I don't see the same backlash or villainization from Bill Maher or David Letterman that was seen from the comments made by Rush Limbaugh. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not condoning Rush Limbaugh's comments, but I just see that as how can one person say, well, it's okay for Bill Maher or David Letterman to make these comments or you know, excuse it as, well,
yeah, I get you, Chris. I feel like we're kind of getting off topic here, repeating the program we did earlier this week. But very, very briefly, Professor Schultz, we talked about apologizing for insulting people or for misspeaking, and certainly Bill Maher and Rush Limbaugh came up in that program because of their recent apologies. I think our listener wants to say that we were more upset with Rush than Bill Maher, apparently. But I'm wondering how this, you think, touches on your topic of polytainment.
Well, sure. I mean, the first thing right off the bat is that We should also concede the fact that Rush Limbaugh was an entertainer, too. I mean, Rush Limbaugh may be sort of the AM version of polytainment, that he figured out a long time ago how to use politics as sort of the venue for delivering, you know, really entertainment, you know. And for anybody who listens to the show, there is an entertainment value in it for the millions of people, or however how many people listen to it. And so I would put Rush Limbaugh in the same category as Comedy Central, appealing to a different demographic, but nonetheless still an entertainment show that merges with politics. It may be that its influence is greater, I don't know, or that it goes in different directions, but there's no question about it. But the fact that an entertainment show that somebody has to apologize for comments, which most people would concede were probably rather insulting, suggests something really interesting in terms of how an entertainment show like that can have the amount of political influence, especially over a 20, 25 year period, however many years Rush Limbaugh has been on. So in many ways, you know, his show really does capture, you know, another aspect of polytainment, that polytainment is not just television, it's not just the web and so forth. It really is all forms of the media and all forms of communication.
We're talking with David Schultz. He is author of Polytainment, The 10 Rules of Contemporary Politics. And we're talking about this concept of polytainment and how it is, how it's playing out in the 2012 elections. And we're welcoming your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. It's going to be a mostly sunny day today, but on the cool side, with highs ranging from the upper 40s in the north to near 60 in the south. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
And then to know that Reverend Al Green was here. So in love with you.
Yeah, well, President Obama, a big hit when he sang a little Al Green at an event not that long ago. We are talking about the politician as entertainer and vice versa, this merger of politics and entertainment that our guest calls polytainment. And he says we can, you know, see this playing out on the campaign trail. And we're welcoming your thoughts and questions. David Schultz is author of Polytainment, The 10 Rules of Contemporary Politics. Was that polytainment, Professor Schultz?
That was polytainment moment, because it did a couple of things. One of them is that everybody reported it. Even though when you think about it on one level, it's not a news story on one level. It has no news value whatsoever, but everybody covered it. And again, if you're talking about candidates being brands, candidates being products to be sold, you know, it's suddenly people heard him doing an Al Green song, and For some demographics of the population who probably weren't paying much attention to Barack Obama or the news are going on, it probably was a situation where they said, "Oh, he's singing or something like that. This guy's kind of cool or something like that." And that becomes important, because again, it's getting a name out, it's getting a positive image out, and in the same way that for all kinds of products, you want to know whether or not people have favorable or unfavorable images of it. You know, we're looking at presidential opinion polls right now that are tracking, you know, favorable, unfavorable ratings of the president, of Mitt Romney and so forth. An Al Green moment is a way to help give you a positive image and help on those favorables.
Yeah, and I know then we had Mitt Romney singing the Star Spangled Banner a week or so after the Al Green song, and people were comparing whether Mitt Romney was a better singer, which he was not.
He was not. It's also, of course, the Star Spangled Banner is a harder song to sing,
yes,
too. For all of us who had to sing that in high school, it's impossible.
Right. Ann in Green Bay is with us. Hello, Ann.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead, please.
Okay. I just had a quick comment regarding Barack Obama's election. I was wondering, what did you think the influence that Oprah had on his winning the election? Because she was, you know, such a popular media person, and she supported him so much. So
right.
That's a great question. No, the answer is it had a tremendous influence in a couple of ways. First, the fact that she was out there endorsing him. I mean, she helped bring crowds. I mean, Barack Obama was getting crowds himself, but she brought lots of crowds out to come see him. But also, if you remember, she, I think if I remember correctly, he appeared on her show, or Michelle Obama appeared on his show at least a couple of times. And again, it reached out to a new demographic. Again, people who might not otherwise watch mainstream news watched it. And one of the things that was important about Barack Obama, and I talk about this in my book also, is that, you know, one of the rules of politics is it's a bar fight. A bar fight in the sense that you want to appeal to swing voters to bring them over to your side. That the most important swing voter in American politics still remains, you know, the suburban soccer mom. And a show like Oprah was heavily watched by suburban, you know, soccer moms across the United States. And by being on Oprah, he could reach a new audience of people that might not otherwise catch him again at the nightly news because, you know, I have to be honest, women were probably taking care of the family, taking care of dinner or something like that. And that's why I think, you know, even moving forward right now in terms of, you know, shows that you might see influential this coming year, again, look to see, you know, the Ellen DeGeneres show, for example, being perhaps almost important. But no question, Oprah had a huge impact in terms of helping Barack Obama in terms of his presidency 4 years ago.
Sajal in Menominee Falls is with us next. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, I'm just going to take you back 5 or 6 minutes into your show. I was struck by the comment about, this older lady thinking Mitt Romney was a snot and contrasting that with, you know, George Bush, and you'd love to have a beer with him. If I sort of take it over to the Democratic side, I was just trying to compare Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. And the dots that I wanted to connect was, you know, I wonder if the narrative is the way to solve for this, to be an intellectual and still relate to people at the same time. Yeah. And if that's an accurate hypothesis on the narrative, what are the magic ingredients to get the narrative right? Is it authenticity? And I'd love to hear your guest's perspective on that.
Thank you.
Okay, a couple of things. One, you know, part of that narrative, as I mentioned to you, you know, it's got to be that a good story. It's got to be about the future. It's got to be optimistic. It's got to be something in terms of inspiring passion into people, and it has to be something that, in the end, it reflects who you really are. Now, I can sort of give you those basic rules in terms of saying what they're supposed to be, but how you actually put them together, at some point, the product does matter. I mean, in the same way that, you know, a car, the soft drink, the food or whatever like that, ultimately, you know, you can't sell something that's really bad unless you're a genius at selling it. The product still matters. And that's what we have to get back, you know, to here, is that how do we take who the product is, who the candidate is, and do the right packaging to make it sell. And one of the things that's difficult to sell in American politics seems to be sort of the intellectual who runs for office. And we have a long history of that, you know, whether it goes back to the 1950s, you know, with Adlai Stevenson, to Michael Dukakis in 88 came across as sort of a technocrat, but who was relatively passionless, you know, 2004, John Kerry again, you know, who came across as competent, but not inspiring. And so we seem to have, you know, and Richard Hofstadter, famous historian, sort of talked about sort of that anti-intellectual strain in American culture. It seems to be hard to really sort of package, you know, sort of being bright and intelligent in terms of pulling it off. But somehow, somebody like Bill Clinton did pull it off, a very bright person. Barack Obama did pull it off. And I think it was because they weren't stressing their intelligence. They weren't stressing how smart they are. They were stressing other aspects in terms of who they are, in terms of their personalities. And so I'm just not sure, and this may be a little depressing aspect here, I'm not sure one can run for office on the idea of saying that I'm the smartest person in the room, because I don't think that plays well in American culture.
And we're going to have to leave it there because we're out of time. Very interesting. Thank you so much for being with us.
No problem. Bye.
Bye. David Schultz, author of Polytainment, The 10 Rules of Contemporary Politics. Thanks to Rob Ferret, to Bill Martins, and to Amanda Magnus for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. It's our Week in Review coming up. We'll have two guests from different viewpoints talking about all the top state and national political news stories of the week. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.